Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, or it's simpler to use a computer or a smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from NHK Japan, France 24, and Radio Havana, Cuba. We will begin with NHK World Radio Japan. China has been swamped with record-breaking rainfall, with extensive flooding and numerous landslides. The chief executive of TikTok says that they protect user information and will not sell the application. Satellite photos have revealed tens of thousands of tents Israel has set up in South Gaza to evacuate Palestinian civilians from Rafah before the invasion. NHK Japan.
Record-breaking rainfall has forced the evacuation of about 110,000 people in southern China. Extensive flooding and numerous landslides have struck Guangdong province. State-run Xinhua News Agency says 4 people have died, 10 are missing, and some 110,000 have been relocated. China Central Television showed flooded urban areas. Homes were inundated by water over head height as people evacuated in small boats. Local media have quoted weather experts as saying this is the second highest level of precipitation to hit southern China in April since 1961. Officials reportedly say global warming is partly responsible for the disaster. Authorities have called on residents to remain on the alert as the heavy rain may continue for several days.
The chief executive of TikTok is vowing to challenge new U.S. legislation that could see the popular video sharing app banned for American users in less than a year. Washington says the app and its Chinese operator, ByteDance, pose a security risk. TikTok CEO Shou Zexu has dismissed those claims. He says his company has invested billions in protecting user data, giving Americans a powerful way to be seen and heard.
We will keep fighting for your rights in the courts. The facts and the Constitution are on our side.
It comes after U.S. lawmakers passed a bipartisan bill, which President Joe Biden signed into law on Wednesday. It gives ByteDance 270 days to sell TikTok, with the possibility for an up to 90-day extension. If it doesn't happen, the app could be banned in the U.S. TikTok has an estimated 170 million American users. The app's fans have argued banning it infringes on rights to free expression. But the U.S. and other Western countries have taken action over fears the app could be used by the Chinese government to harvest data. Reuters News Agency reports Israel has procured tens of thousands of tents for Palestinian civilians who will be displaced by the battle. It quotes Israeli officials who say their country's war cabinet plans to meet in the next 2 weeks to authorize evacuations from the city. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan says Washington is urging a diplomatic solution. Sullivan also says the U.S. wants answers to the deeply disturbing reports of mass graves in Gaza. Earlier this week, Palestinian authorities say they found over 300 bodies at a hospital in the city of Khan Yunis after Israeli troops withdrew from the facility. Israel denies digging the graves and says its forces were searching for the bodies of hostages among the dead.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan. On shortwave, they are now heard at 10 p.m., at 11735, or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp, and at most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. All the times they announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. Next, France 24. Global military spending has soared to new heights, almost $2.5 trillion, with the U.S. accounting for $1 trillion, or 37% of the total. France 24 broadcast two long interviews this week that I struggled with choosing only one for this show. The first was from a program called Scoop, speaking with Jeremy Scahill from The Intercept on the New York Times, telling its journalist to limit the use of terms like genocide and ethnic cleansing and to avoid the term occupied territory in reporting on the war in Palestine. You will hear a short excerpt from that. The other long interview is with Rashid Khalidi, American historian and the Edward Syed Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University. The topic was that the West was on the wrong side of history for suppressing students in the U.S. and Europe who are demanding a ceasefire in Gaza. He talks about Columbia University's history of student protest, the moral urgency of stopping the war in Gaza, and the problem with mainstream media echoing the government line. He points out that a large proportion of protesters are Jewish, as are scores of professors who are also protesting. He points out that the Republican Party under Trump is hypocritical, since Trump proclaimed as good people the neo-fascists who marched in Virginia a few years ago chanting, "Jews will not replace us." France 24.
A surge in conflict around the world is fueling a surge in military spending. A new report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, reveals that global military expenditure has reached an all-time high, almost $2.5 trillion last year. The US remains the world's biggest spender, dwarfing all other nations. It alone is responsible for almost $1 trillion, or 37% of that global spend. Among the biggest year-on-year increases was Ukraine's. In the second year of the Russian invasion, its spending went up by more than half, while Russia, already the third highest spender worldwide, increased its budget by almost a quarter in 2023. Israel's military outlay went up by the same percentage, much of that coming late in the year.
There was an immediate reaction since Hamas's attack in October, and as a response to, you know, their military campaign, Israeli spending went up month by month immediately after October, and we saw this continue all the way to the end of December.
Simmering tensions have propelled spending increases for nations not in active conflict. China, the number two global spender, increased its military budget by 6% to an estimated $296 billion. And in the shadow of their saber-rattling neighbour, Taiwan and Japan both increased their spending by 11% in 2023.
The driving factor is very much China increasing spending and has an impact on, you know, a lot of the neighboring countries going from Japan all the way down to Southeast Asia, and leading to essentially an action-reaction type of spiral of increases.
Researchers at SIPRI predict the upward trend in spending will continue in the coming years, a reflection, they say, of the deterioration of peace and security around the world.
Reporting is hard in the fog of war, even more so verifying information is impossible at times, and yet the job demands accuracy, impartiality, and to humanize losses on both sides of any conflict. In November, more than 750 journalists from dozens of news organizations signed an open letter condemning Israel's killing of reporters in Gaza and criticizing Western media's coverage of the war. It said, quote, UN experts have warned they are convinced that the Palestinian people are at a grave risk of genocide, yet Western outlets remain hesitant to quote genocide experts and accurately describe the existential threat unfolding in Gaza. This is our job, to hold power to account. Otherwise, we risk becoming accessories to genocide, end quote. Then in January, Oxfam called the war in Gaza the deadliest of the 21st century. It made the statement after reviewing the daily death toll in the war-torn enclave. Among those dead were Hamas militants, but also ordinary civilians, men, women, and children. There were journalists and activists that were killed as well. In the same month, the American nonprofit news organization, The Intercept, published analysis of U.S. media bias against Palestinians. It focused on the first 6 weeks of the conflict. The Intercept reviewed 1,000 articles from the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times, and it found that the mentions of Palestinians in news reports declined even as the death toll soared. Remember, these deaths are why Oxfam called the war the deadliest of the 21st century. Then this week, The Intercept ran a story about a controversial leaked memo at the New York Times. Journalists Jeremy Scahill and Ryan Grimm wrote the piece, and Jeremy joins us on the line to discuss it. Hello to you, Jeremy. Thank you for speaking to us.
And the final point I'll make is this. When you look at the headlines in the New York Times, monitor the use of the passive voice. So many headlines when Palestinians are the victims, you have to guess who is the perpetrator of the violence against them. The New York Times in particular stands out for refusing to name Israel as being the perpetrator of violence against Palestinians so often. It's like the missiles were launched from some unknown entity in outer space rather than a force that has been waging all-out war against the people of Gaza in an intense manner since October 7th and for decades in a less intense but consistent manner.
Yeah, and we know in Journalism 101, passive voice, you don't do it in journalism, yeah. Do you? Jeremy, thank you very much for your time. Jeremy Scahill from The Intercept.
Well, joining us from Nice in the south of France, acclaimed historian Rashid Khalidi. He's the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University. Thank you for speaking with us here on France 24.
Thanks for having me.
Your latest book, The Hundred Years War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and a Resistance. In that report, we saw a campus that you cross every day when you're in New York, and the one which hasn't seen this kind of polarization, arguably, since the Vietnam War.
No, in fact, Columbia's campus has always been a scene of student activism. The movement against apartheid in South Africa in the 1980s was animated by Columbia being the first university to divest from South Africa in response to a student movement. The movement for civil rights, other movements have had companion protest movements on the Columbia campus since the Vietnam War. So you're right, the 60s were the time of the highest level of activism. But since then, Columbia has always had a very high degree of student activism around the issues of the day.
Did you ever think that this would be the cause that would bring Columbia to a halt?
I have to admit, I would have been surprised a few years ago to see this level of activism across the country, to see overwhelming majorities of Americans opposing the Biden administration's policies, to see hundreds of trade unions coming out for a permanent ceasefire. But over the past 6 months, it's been 6.5 months now, it's been perfectly clear that American public opinion has shifted significantly as far as its view of Palestine and Israel and as far as its view of right and wrong. I think there's a sense that Israel's war on Gaza has caused untold harm and that American taxpayers are responsible. It's our money that funds this war. It's American weapons that are used to kill so far 34,000 Palestinians, including 13,000 children. And that the moral urgency that that involves, I think, has particularly affected young people in the United States.
Affected young people. At the same time, there's this bristling from older generations because of the memory of World War II, because of the fact that it began with October 7th and the Hamas attack and the killing of innocent civilians. Do you, your thoughts on how it's evolved in those 5.5 months in not just the United States, but also campuses in France, here in Europe?
Well, I think you're right. I think there's a big divide between an older generation and a younger generation. I think the older generation, to be very frank, depends on mainstream media. And mainstream media has tended to echo the government line. And the government line in Western Europe and the United States has been essentially read off an Israeli teleprompter. Whatever the Israeli government is saying, President Biden, his administration, Rishi Sunak and his government and so forth, repeat almost almost monotonously. Younger people do not pay attention to the mainstream media. They look at alternative media, they look at social media, and they see live-streamed genocide from Gaza. They know better, I think, what's going on, frankly, than the older generation. They have different views, they have different beliefs, perhaps, but they see a reality that, frankly, the mainstream media is protecting older people from seeing. And the second thing that I would say is that it's not just younger people, at least in the United States. Look at the opinion polls. The Biden administration's policy on Gaza is wildly unpopular. The president's position is a minority position, maybe in his age group, people in their 80s or their 70s, but not the majority of Americans in their 30s, 40s, and 50s or across age groups. And I think it's really important to point that out, and to point out the fact also that a lot of what's going on these campuses is being very poorly reported. For example, they say Jewish students feel unsafe. I would argue a very large proportion of the protesters are themselves Jewish. Dozens and dozens and dozens of Jewish faculty members, many of whom remember the Holocaust, many of whom lost relatives in the Holocaust, many of whom teach things like about the Holocaust, have supported the students. So to say Jewish students feel X, Y, or Z, and to assume that that represents all of them is entirely false. Israel students feel uncomfortable, and there's some reason for them feeling that way. But I don't think that's true of either Jewish students or Jewish faculty, by and large, on the Columbia campus or on many other campuses.
So why did the president of Columbia University call in the New York City police?
Well, I think she was acting under the pressure that American politicians, particularly from the Republican Party, have been putting on her, as well as pressure that donors and trustees have been putting on her. I mean, let's be frank. The people who govern the United States are mainly in the upper age brackets. They're very conservative, by and large. Even the leadership of the Democratic Party, the president himself, Senator Schumer, and so forth. And they're all very committed to Israel. And that pressure we could see in the congressional hearings, which led to the firing a couple months ago of two presidents of Ivy League universities, and which led to her being forced or feeling forced to grovel before this committee, to throw several of my colleagues under the bus, to say and do things that are violations of all kinds of academic protocols, out of a desperate hope that she could escape the kind of fate that two of her colleagues met a couple of months earlier. I think that she called in the police under the same kinds of pressures, political pressures, media pressures, pressures from donors and trustees.
And now we're just a few weeks away from graduation day, and that's a time when a lot of those big donors come to campus. So what's her fate?
Well, I think it's still to be decided. I think that she is going to have to come to terms with the students to some degree. The students are demanding a number of things, but one of the things that they're demanding is that Columbia divest from companies that support a 56-year-old illegal Israeli occupation. In June, it'll be 57 years. Now, this is not a new demand by the students. In 2020, Columbia students overwhelmingly voted in favor of divestment. This has been a continuing demand of large majorities of Columbia students for now four and a half years. I don't know whether she's going to feel able to accept that or some of the other demands, but I think she's going to have to compromise if she wants these students to leave without having to bring in the police once more. Last time she brought the police in, it worsened the situation. We'll see what happens. I hope that calmer heads will prevail and that the university, instead of using hard-knuckle tactics, will come to terms with what I think represents an overwhelming majority of student opinion and of faculty opinion, for that matter.
Where does this end?
Well, I think one has to look very carefully at a Republican Party led by Donald Trump, who proclaimed that neo-fascists marching under torchlights at the University of Virginia a few years ago were good people, while they chanted, "Jews will not replace us." That's the Republican Party of today. The idea that these people have any concern about anti-Semitism is ridiculous. What they want to do is muzzle and control higher education. They don't like the liberal bent of the students and of many of the faculty. That's their real agenda. It has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. That is just a cover for a right-wing agenda to do as much as possible to control higher education. They make no bones about it. They're very blunt about it. People like Elise Stefanik, who's led the questioning in that House subcommittee of both President Shafiq and earlier presidents, is herself very close to anti-Semitic groups all over the country. The idea that she cares about Jewish students is absurd. This is a stick to beat higher education with. And I'm sure that the speaker will be exploiting that to the utmost when he visits Colombia today.
Rashid Halidi, one final question. So you're in France right now, where we're having the same kinds of arguments, meetings canceled, accusations leveled of people supporting Hamas in some cases, politicians, because they've made outspoken statements. Taking a step back, how does it seem here compared to how it seems in the United States?
I mean, I can't speak to politicians in France, but I can speak to the academic situation here in the UK and in Germany. And it's appalling. You have had universities cracking down solely on events involving support for the Palestinians. Support for people who are being subjected to a genocide does not mean people are anti-Semitic. Support for people being subjected to a genocide does not mean that they necessarily support Hamas. It means they don't want their countries, France, Germany, UK, United States, to be complicit in genocide. It's perfectly simple. This is a red herring, whether they support Hamas or they're terrorists or whatever. Most opponents of Israel's war on Gaza simply want Israel to stop slaughtering Palestinians. 34,000 so far, 10,000 under the rubble, probably also dead. Almost 13,000 of those are children. Anybody who doesn't oppose that kind of slaughter, frankly, is lacking a certain moral sense. And your universities, your government, the governments of Western Europe and the United States, frankly, are on the wrong side of history. Long after the Vietnam War, everybody realized, oh, that was a terrible mistake. Your president at the time opposed it. Long after the Iraq War, everybody realized the Iraq War was a mistake. Actually, your president at the time also opposed it. But now, the same people who are supporting this war, that everybody's going to see one day as a horrible, horrible set of war crimes, is blind to that. And I think, frankly, your university administrations are on the wrong side of history. Students should be allowed to organize events which support Palestinians who are being slaughtered in these conditions.
Rashid Halidi, so many thanks for speaking with us from Nice.
Those reports and interviews were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. They are also available at most podcast sites. The complete interview with Jeremy Scahill is also online as a podcast called Scoop, which, like France 24, is up at most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the Shortwave Report or could help support this listener-funded program, you can write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California 95490. My online support information is available at outfarpress.com. Your donations are essential for the weekly production and distribution of this show to continue. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. Colombian President Petro, under pressure for promoting universal health care, free education, and pensions, will be present at rallies for International Workers' Day, May Day. Thousands of pro-Palestinian demonstrators marched on Madrid last Sunday to oppose arms sales to Israel. A flotilla of ships carrying food and supplies for Palestine is being prepared in Turkey. Radio Havana, Cuba.
The president of Colombia, Gustavo Petro, has announced that he will participate in the massive rally on May the 1st within the framework of International Workers' Day. In a message published on his official account on the social network, he said, quote, "I will go as before, walking. I hope you will accompany me throughout the country. It will be a walk for labor dignity." This according to the Colombian head of state. He added that May the 1st will be a day for all health workers to leave because their job stability is about to be achieved. Quote, "For the right to retire, for a better salary, and for cheap loans for the popular economy, let the peasantry go out to the city and the indigenous people for agrarian reform." Petro said, "Let the young people of the popular neighborhoods come out in droves, remember that I am their president, to sing, to dance, to fight for free higher education and for youth cooperative credit," he continued. The Colombian president observed that the general mobilization of citizens has been called, and from there the constituent power, that is the power of the people. May Day is a beautiful day to show the power of the people who work, study, and create. Quote, the hatred is theirs, the spiritual violence that does not want education to reach the people. The plate of hot soup to the old man and the doctor to the pregnant woman and the girl. They do not want the working woman to have dignity. Ours is joy, peace, and love. Thousands of pro-Palestinian demonstrators marched through the streets of Madrid on Sunday to demand an end to Israel's war in Gaza, while holding banners calling on the Spanish government to halt arms sales to Israel. Activists also called for an immediate ceasefire and the release of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. Quote, you can stop selling arms to Israel and impose economic boycott. Peacefully, you can do many things to force Israel to change its attitude, said protester Carlos Calamita. A huge Palestinian flag and a balloon in the shape of a zeppelin with the slogan, End the Arms Trade with Israel, led the demonstration. Quote, we demand that the government put an end to its arms trade with Israel. If European governments and the United States would stop selling arms to Israel in only 3 days, it would no longer have the ammunition to kill the Palestinian civilian population, unquote, pro-Palestinian activists said. A flotilla of ships carrying 5,000 tons of food, drinking water and medical aid is expected to depart from Turkey in the coming days in an attempt to break Israel's blockade of the Palestinian enclave and bring much needed relief to citizens of the war-torn Gaza. During a press conference on Friday, Freedom Flotilla Coalition, the FFC, an international humanitarian organization which is involved in the relief effort, announced that at least 3 vessels are set to depart from the western Turkish port of Tuzla in the Sea of Marmara, south of Istanbul. Approximately 1,000 professionals, doctors, lawyers and academics are set to join the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, hoping to set sail from Istanbul for the besieged enclave despite Israel's threats. No departure date has yet been set, as organizers said they are now waiting for permission to sail from the Turkish authorities. Activists from 12 national human rights groups from various countries, including Germany, Malaysia, Palestine, Norway, Argentina, Spain, Canada, and South Africa, accompanied by journalists, will reportedly participate in this effort.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 28th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. While I'm recuperating from spinal injury, I'm staying at a house that is connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.